Hello and welcome to pod 57 of the official Palace pod. I'm Chris Grissom from Palace TV, which you can watch on eagles.cpfc.co.uk, on the official club app, which you can download from the Google Play Store or the App Store, on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and TikTok. There's different kinds of videos all across all of those channels. And if you haven't listened to the Palace pod before, I understand this one because of the guests we've got on it, you might be listening for the first time. Throughout the season, what we do is we take interviews that we've done for Palace TV and we turn them into a podcast. A lot of the time we'll be putting the full interview, so it'll be stuff that you haven't heard in the short little video that we've edited an interview down to. So there is a lot of exclusive stuff. We also have a character called Statman that we talk to in the build-up to every Premier League game to get all of the historical stats from the team that we're playing against. But during lockdown, we've been using it as an opportunity to turn the Instagram live interviews that we've done and also the other lockdown interviews with heroes for the rewinds that we've had. We've turned those into podcasts as well because they're quite long interviews. So sometimes it's a lot easier to listen on the move when you're out for a run or a walk. So welcome if you are a first-time listener to the Palace podcast, and please do feel free to go back through all the old podcasts and have a listen to them. So you are listening to this pod because you want to hear from Dougie Friedman, who is the sporting director at Crystal Palace. But this interview is all about his playing career. He had an incredible playing career in two spells at Palace. And then we also touch on him being assistant manager at the Sheffield Wednesday game and then how he then got given the role as manager of the club. We're actually going to save the talk of the 12-13 season and his departure from the club then for a later time, because we're putting together a little documentary about the 12-13 season, so we'd rather save it for when we've got all our high quality cameras pointing at it. But for now, yeah, it's a really interesting look at his playing career and the early bit of his management. So without further ado, here is Dougie Friedman talking to me recently on Zoom. If we talked about your whole Palace career, we'd be here about 3 hours, so we'll save some of the other nice bits for when we've got more fancy cameras around. So let's talk about the three games that we've shown. So the Man United Carling Cup game as manager, the Hillsborough game as assistant manager, and the Stockport County game as a player. So just to give a bit of background for those watching that weren't around back then in 2001. What was your journey before that? Because you'd been at Palace, which is when I remember you most, actually, in the first period, 95 to 97. How did it come about you moving to Palace in the first place?
I had to leave Queen's Park Rangers the year before, who were in the Premier League, top of the Premier League, in fact, the top three or four. And I then went to Barnet to get football. You know, at this particular time, Les Ferdinand, Bradley Allen, you know, were in the team at QPR. Kevin Gallen was behind us. So I went to Barnet, went down there for a year, loved it, scored a lot of goals. And then I got a phone call, just literally, back in the time, Chris, there wasn't any mobile phones, mate. So I was living in Diggs. So I got a call in the Diggs, roughly about 11 o'clock at night, from the Barnet chairman, just said, "We've sold you to Crystal Palace." Just as simple as that. And I says, "Right." He said, "Someone's going to call you back in 10 minutes. And he said, "Good luck." Very, very simple. So just previous to that, I'd turned down a few offers to go back into the Premier League. At Everton, at Tottenham, and at Terry Venables, because I just come from QPR when I wasn't playing. I just loved playing. So I looked at Crystal Palace, who were kind of, at that particular time, a little bit yo-yo. You know, they just get relegated, and I felt that that's a good opportunity for me to play. 10 minutes later, Roy Rhodes calls me. He says, "Be at this address tomorrow at 9:30, and we can talk about your career and what it looks like." It's very, very simple. So at the time, I had a 1.1 Fiesta. So I'm driving from Shepherd's Bush down to Croydon, which took about 3 hours. So I didn't know about the traffic at that time. So the time I got there was about 10:30. Roy Rhodes said to me, first ever quote he said to me, he said, "You're late, it's 10:30, what do you call this?" And I said to him, "You're lucky I'm here." And I quickly backtracked and said to him, "Because of the traffic." You know, and I'm trying to make up all these excuses of the traffic. So 10:30, got there late, and that was it. It just taken off. Stevie Cuttle was around, but Ray Lou, Peter Nicholas was the managers. literally, as soon as I spoke to him, I just gave me the pen, I'm signing. I just loved really what they were all about, and you know, the characters that were in the sort of team at the time. I'd known all of them, and it just felt really at ease. I played, me and Gareth Taylor came roughly the same time. Ray Lewington was there as a coach, very, very good coach, and I don't know if I hit the ground running, because you know what I'm like, mate, my memory's not great and I don't really look back too often, but I just remember being very comfortable in the surroundings and the environment that was created. Stevie Cutt was always doing his job around the pitch. I think at the time he was sporting director or director of football. I just remember seeing this little guy who everybody knew running around the pitch during training, and it just felt very ease. Scored a few goals that season. Disappointing end, because we lost in the final, and then carried on in the second year, where we got promotion that year again. Did a little bit of a stop start season through injury, not getting back in the team. Ended up getting to the final. I'm sure everybody remembers David Hopkin, which I actually didn't play. In fact, David Hopkin last minute. It was very good. At that particular time, I was getting offered a contract as soon as we got that summer. So I was negotiating a contract the whole summer. Didn't have an agent, never dealt with agents. And, you know, I was meeting Ron Knowles at the time. And as I was going through that contract negotiation, when I say negotiation, he was offering and I was accepting or not. It wasn't a negotiation. I was seeing players coming in. Lombardo come in, wonderful player, probably the best player I've ever played with. David Hopkin was leaving, and it was difficult for me to accept this. These were good friends. And literally three or four games into the season, Ron Knowles picked up the phone. No, in fact, it was Stevie Cutwell picked up the phone. Now, by this time, I've got a mobile phone, Chris, about 97, 98. And he said, "We've just sold you to Wolves." Just like that. You know, it's back in that day. It's crazy when you think about just like that. And you say, okay. Again, you get a call in 10 minutes. Mark McGee picked up the phone. I went and spoke to him. And I went and signed. Wrong decision. Many times I've made difficult, wrong decisions, and it's turned out not to be great, and that was one of them.
Yeah, so you, I mean, in that time that you were away, so you went to Wolves and then you were at Forest, there's loads going on back at Palace. We got bought out by Mark Goldberg, went into administration. Yeah. So then when you came back in October 2000, how different was the club then?
Well, it wasn't really that different. Simon Jordan had taken over, and it wasn't, you know, I think it was only there two or three months before I arrived, so it wasn't a lot different. There's a lot of my good friends there. Leon McKenzie, you know, was there. I played with young Leon for the first time round, so there's a lot of people that I kind of knew. I was not in Forest. I got a phone call from Simon Jordan. He said, "Look, we've just bought you." Because it sounds crazy at the time, but there was no real big news about these things or no tip-offs. He's literally, your phone rings, you answer, "Simon Jordan, I bought the club, I want you to come back. I know you are this amount. I'll give you a little bit more. Would you think?" And that was it. I just straight back. That day, in fact, in the car going. And in fact, it's... And I used to cherish, I don't really take a lot of souvenirs with me at all, but I really cherished my boots at the time. You know, my boots were everything. I was a bit old school when it came to that. They'd come everywhere with me. And I remember just leaving them at Nottingham Forest and driving down the motorway and being more anxious about how I'm going to get my boots than actually how the day is. When I arrived, Simon Jordan was good. Alan Smith was a manager. And half the summer of the club just told me the project and what they were thinking and where they were. Clint Morrison and Leo McKenzie were the duo at the time. Mikel Forsell, a little bit younger. And he just said, "Look, I want you to come and have a bit of experience and bring the qualities you bring." And that was it, really. You know, we got off and running again.
So how would you have described yourself as a striker? Because you weren't... I always describe you as like the Championship Bergkamp. Like that kind of maybe just off the main striker role, skillful, scoring lots of goals. Yeah. How would you describe yourself?
Yeah, that'll do, Chris. I'll take that. That's sure. You'll see I am. And that's, I wasn't. I kind of played the way I wanted to play. you know, without really, I'm not a fantastic sort of reader of what other players do or what people think. I played my style and my way, and that upset a lot of managers, and that upset a lot of teammates. But then I just felt that's the only way I could play in my way. At any given time, it's very interesting you say that, because my game was all about running in behind. And if you actually really watch it, that's where I scored a lot of goals, running in behind. I felt that I could have the intelligence at certain games to mix my game up, as you just say, come in and receive the ball with feet and play a little bit. But I really enjoyed the actual running in behind, which I was taught years and years ago by the great Don Howe. See, this is why I'm very eager for young players in the academy right now, really putting in an infrastructure and coaching. Because I was a street kid from Glasgow that played, you know, in the concrete, 4 or 5 hours every night. And when I come to QPR when I was 16, Don Howe had just come back from the World Cup, and he would take the youth team in the afternoons with Mike Kelly. They'd just come back from the World Cup, Chris. Mm-hmm. Just imagine that, you know, my feeling getting taught by the great Don Howe when to make runs, how to make runs, how to always make the defender think. So I would describe myself as a maker and taker of goals, pretty much in that order. And that's what I kind of got a thrill out of. I got a thrill out of if the defender stopped me, then I would make space for my teammates and create that way.
So that season, the 2000-2001 season, wasn't great in the league, but had a good run in the League Cup. Do you have any good memories of that run?
I haven't, because I was in the stand. I couldn't play because I played for Nottingham Forest. Yeah, I think I played for Nottingham Forest in the early stages. But I just remember, I can remember Stephen Thompson scoring a goal at Leicester. And I remember a little, with a little winger, little Latvian kid. I remember him running away for the park and scoring as well.
Rubens,
that's it. Yeah. Good memory. See, I told you my memory's not great. And I remember that. But that was affecting our league. It really was, because I think, and it often does that, Chris, and I think when we maybe got onto the Man United game, you know, and I really don't think a lot back, but I had to, you know, refresh my memory, because you're going to ask me these questions. That when you have good cup runs, normally the league suffers, because the focus gets on to actually trying to win something rather than trying to win a league, which is, of anyone will tell you, it's very difficult to go through the whole season. You know, the endurance you needed. So we were strong in the league, if I can recall, and it was getting to a stage where I think everybody at the club was getting more excited about the cup rather than the league. And that's how we found ourselves at the bottom. And unfortunately, that's how we found ourselves. Alan Smith lost his job, which was very difficult to take, because he's a good man.
Yeah, so he lost his job, and then Steve Kemba took over for the last two games of the season. You needed to win both of them. How did you approach a week like that?
That was my best week in football, because ever. And I don't think I'll ever, ever over, you know, it'll trump that, Chris, because you have a feeling that there's a goal or a challenge being set to you, and it's a very clear challenge. You've got to win two games. You've got to go to Portsmouth, you've got to go stop what you won two games. And then you ask yourself, is it achievable? And you look around the dressing room, you think, yeah, I think it is. You know, Hayden Mullins and Clint Morris and David Hopkin and Jamie Smith. And, you know, you think, yeah, this is achievable. Dean Austin was there. This is achievable. And then you start building the confidence slowly. Think to yourself, what are you going to bring to the party? And then you kind of think, well, I know if he's playing and he's playing, then I'll definitely bring this to the party. And then Stevie Kemba's approach was very different from Alan Smith. Alan was a coach who spent a lot of time at training grounds. Stevie Kemba was more of a manager who was, you know, give the players more responsibility, you know, make it very relaxed, very calm. Even if the outcome wasn't to swing your way, there would always be a feeling of love around the place. You know, kind of been there, seen it in direct, Stevie Kemba. So he kind of brought that in part as a manager. And he kind of relaxed his staff, Terry Bullivan, Victor Bertinelli. I remember, you know, these people also feeling more relaxed around the place, which spread into the team. Portsmouth by far was the best game that I've ever played. You know, I felt that We had Kirill Lahti right behind me. You know, Stevie Kebber played a very attack-minded team, Chris. And we just, let's say, destroyed them, you know, from the first minute. You know, it was fantastic to play in. The wavelength that me and Clint were on that time. Me and Clint have spent, I don't know, 7 or 8 years knowing each other. Not always getting on with each other. You know, I'll be the first to say that. You know, his off-the-field life was different from mine. Nothing wrong with it. I'm going to criticise it in a different way. But when we got on the pitch, there was something like good wavelength. And that peaked in that particular moment where I literally knew every single move that he was making and vice versa. So we went there. We won the game easily, to be honest with you. That kind of gave us huge confidence because that lifted us up off the top three, Chris.
Mm.
And that gives huge confidence to all we've got to do is go to Stockport and win. Now, it's not as easy as that, but that was the feeling at the time. I can't remember anything else. I can't remember the cool down, the warm down. If it was up to Stevie Cutler, we'd probably be in the cafe, eating sandwich and having a chat. Probably done that. And then off we go to Stockport, which wasn't a great game. You know, can't recall a lot of moments. I can recall a half time. You know, a few same bits and pieces what we think is needed, and I can remember still having the energy on a very hot day that if the ball came to me that I would you know, I had the energy to do something, and I kind of feel that kind of game, it taught me a lot when I went into coaching, Chris, because it taught me that I was waiting for the right moment and saving my energy. And lucky enough, and I say lucky enough, I got the ball at the right time with the right energy to score a goal. But when I went into my coaching, the kind of players that I am and I coached, I wouldn't let them do that because I felt that I'm not willing to wait till the last minute for the ball to arrive at your feet to win this game. So I'm going to put a little bit more structure and a little bit more emphasis on the team, you know, rather than that luck. No, lucky. That moment I got the ball, I saved my energy, but it was a little bit too close to the wire for my liking. And then obviously after the game, you know, it was a 3 or 4 minute spell where we didn't know quite where we were. And then we got the news that it went our way.
Yeah, have you watched the footage of that? Because the TV cameras were there filming the fans in the stands with their massive radios or massive mobile phones. And then the celebrations in the dressing room after. Have you seen all of that?
Well, funny enough, because I only seen it for the first time about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm sure you're going to tell me it was anniversary or something like that. Somebody sent me a little clip. And at the first moment, I thought, this is 5 minutes long. I haven't got 5 minutes of my life to sit and watch. But I pressed play, and it then sort of slowly, I wore a smile by the end of the 5 minutes, because it did give me some good memories. And then you're right, in the dressing room afterwards, some old faces. But at the time, Chris, see, I'm very much a private kind of guy. And at the time, I went into the toilet, as I did at the Sheffield Wednesday, and just locked a cubicle and just sat there. Not actually in the toilet. Well, I was in the toilet, but not actually. But I just sat, locked a cubicle and just listened to the noise. So I actually asked myself, when I watched the little clip, where was I? And then I recall where I was, and I was very happy when the cameras were going to come back out.
Yeah, because you ran straight down the tunnel, didn't you, at the end of the game? We've got that shot of you. You took one look around. It looks like you're in a film. You kind of take one look around at everyone and then disappear.
Yeah. The reason, because I was near the dugout, because I remember I'd just come off of, not a great story, but maybe 4 or 5 years earlier, we were playing Millwall. I remember Dean Gordon scored a great goal and the crowd running on, but it was a Millwall crowd that ran on. I was right beside them. And that stuck in my mind a little bit. So in that particular game, you know, instincts take over. And I remember looking to Stevie Kemper and I was saying to him, you know, what are we doing? And he was saying, 1 minute, 1 minute. And I was saying, no, what's the other scores? And I was trying to interact with him a little bit, and the game was 30 seconds to go. So when they blew the final whistle, I thought, I'll get down a tunnel and find out the other score, because that was the kind of job that had been done. I wanted to get and find the score. That's why I went straight into the toilet. Seeing Brian, the kit man, I was saying to him, was the radio? He didn't have a radio, so we were just waiting for the noise to happen. That was how I found out.
But just going back to the goal, when you scored that, it's the 87th minute. Were you feeling then that, I mean, that's it, that's the game won?
Yeah, I did feel that. Yeah, I did. I was, when you're a forward, when you're a forward-thinking player, you really, you get your confidence from your defenders. You know, that's where you get your real confidence. You know that if you score a goal, your defence can hold out, or, you know, if it's 0-0, you ain't going to concede, you know, even if you've missed a chance. You get confidence from that. So when I scored a goal, in the, you know, to the Stockport game, I did think it was over. Yes, I did. Because there's no confidence in sort of the goalkeeper at the time, Kalinko, and Hayden Mullins and these people I was watching, you know. So I had confidence we'd win the game, yes, to answer, yes, I did.
Looking at their team, actually, on that day, they had Shefki Kuchi and Aaron Wilbraham up front. Yeah. I can't believe Wilbs is still going.
Yeah, I think, at the time, I didn't know their team. I just remember this, what we'll share with you, Chris, and probably not, well, people will know this, but they won't talk about it. 6 months later, because Stockport were desperate to put us down, and I mean, that was a tough game. That wasn't an easy game. At Stockport last game, they had nothing to play for, but they were, you know, pretty much in fifth gear until the last minute. And although as a sportsman you expect that, you also expect there's a little bit of feeling around the place that, you know, you ain't played for nothing. We're fighting for our lives here. 6 months, three months later, we played them again at Selhurst Park and we beat them 4-0. And I can remember really being up for that game. I can't remember if I scored or not, but I can remember really being up for the game and really rubbing into them and really making sure they remembered us. And that was the feeling I can remember from not just that game, but from Stockport, the team, you know, the real anger towards them. Six months, or whatever it was, 3 or 4 months later, we played them.
One of your teammates that day, Aki Rialati, we went out to Helsinki to film with him a few years ago. I know you two are quite good friends. I'm sure he cracked the joke with you at the time. He likes saying that no one can understand what you're saying. So he'll be pleased to see that you've got an English dictionary behind you there on your shelf.
Oh, yes. And French and Spanish. I told you, the kids are at school, Chris. That's not mine, mate. That's for the kids.
But Aki, yeah, how good? Just tell me a bit about that friendship, because obviously you're both doing slightly different roles, but similar kind of roles at clubs.
Well, you know what? In football, which is very sad, in football, you go through 20-odd years, and in the end, which is very sad, you kind of get close to maybe a handful of players, if that, Chris, really if that, you know, because, of course, when you see them, you know, it's great memories, but you don't stay in contact because the competition in the end drives you away. Because although you're playing for the team, it drives you away from each other when you stop playing. But I'm glad to see Aki as one of the handful of people that I do, you know, stay in touch with and very close to. And matter of fact, I heard someone, a Palace fan, a month ago say something to me that I've never heard before again. Never heard anybody say this. And probably never heard anybody say it again. I was talking to an older gentleman, you know, over the phone a month ago, and make sure he was okay, and, you know, having a chat with him. And I just asked him, "Who's your favourite player?" He'd watched the team for 60-odd years. I said, "Who's your favourite player?" And I'm expecting Ian Wright, Mark Bright, you know, Jim Cannon, you know, these people. You know, I might even get a mention here myself. I'm sort of waiting for it. And he said, "Aki Rialati." Because at the time, I actually nearly fell off my chair. I've never heard it before. So I really was inquisitive to the fellow. I said, "You've got to tell me why. What? Why?" And he really spoke very passionate. And I said, "Right, hold the line." And I got Aki on the line. And I said, "Aki, I'm going to put you on the line, a gentleman. He thinks you're the best ever Crystal Palace player. And I just want to know, do you know him? Is it your good friend? Is it a relation of yours?" And I connected the two of them up. And I got a text from the fella saying he had a great time. And it was true. He was Aki's favourite player. So he wasn't only a good guy. He was, in some people's eyes, a good player as well.
Right, fast forwarding on a bit. So that was 2001. A few years later, when did you very first start coaching?
You only need to do the maths. I'm 45 now, when I was 29. So me and Tony Popovich thought we were the best coaches since sliced bread. We thought we better give this a go. So we got our whistle and a notepad and pen, and we went down to Millwall's training ground because there was a coaching course going on there. And we soon discovered we were not. We had all these ideas, and we soon discovered that we couldn't get it across in a certain way that people understood. So that became a long, passionate journey, which lasted about maybe 9 years, Chris, on coaching courses, development courses, you know, mental strength courses, you name it. It wasn't just in football. You know, I really threw myself into try to teach. You know, I had this knowledge, and I tried to get it over. And I think that's the key to coaching. I think many people, not just ex-player, but many people can study the game and look at the game, but that's actually getting it over to, you know, your colleagues in such a way that they understand it and they take it on board and they take action on what you've asked them to do. So at 29 years of age, me and Tony, we started and we just plugged away. And a big decision come my way, Chris, that thankfully I got this one right, that I went to Leeds for a few years at the end of my career, which had a good, real good time. I enjoyed it. Neil Warnock was great because Neil Warnock gave me the reserve job about 32, 33. And he said, I think you'll be good at it. And it was a fantastic 6 months because I literally done everything. I drove the van. I got in the van. I drove players like Bostock and Victor Moses, were in the reserves at the time. I would drive them to Aldershot. That was our home games. I'd play in the reserve game, take the team, play in the reserve game, talk to one or two of the younger players, drive the coach back, empty the van, put the skips away, and turn up the next morning, the Tuesday morning, to train with the first team and, you know, carry on that way. Looking back, I thought, she's done off, it's quite me, but it was a great little quick, learning curve. I played at Leeds. We lost in the final against Doncaster on a Sunday. It was my birthday, honestly, the 25th of May on that day, and I had to start my two-week coaching course at Lillishaw on the Monday morning. So I had to drive up to Lillishaw that night from London. And it was a big decision because I sat there on the sofa at 8 o'clock at night, you know, just being lost at Wembley and thinking, right, what am I going to go in life here? And it was a big effort, Chris, you know, to pack the bag, not see the kids, drive up, fare was up to Lillishaw and stay up there for 2 weeks and start the coaching course, which was a great course. It was actually an invitation-only course where Gary Neville, Zola, Ryan Gibbs, Solskjaer, there's a lot of people got invited onto this course, only 20 of us, which was a real insight to how these guys work. It really benefited me, myself. It was a good decision.
And then how did you find yourself back at Palace as assistant manager under Paul Hart?
Yeah, well, I knew Paul Hart because at Nottingham Forest, he was the youth team boss. So, when he gave me a call, Phil Alexander kind of was putting things together and Paul Hart gave me a call and just said, look, and I was still playing at Southend. You know, I was still playing. I had a 2 or 3 year contract left. I was still playing and enjoying myself. And Paul Hart came back and said, look, the club just went in administration. I've been called to do a job for 6 months. I need some help. I need something that's close to the players, still fit enough to demonstrate some drills. And I used drills, you know, I knew it. And at this time, I was really into my coaching. And it's a sad thing when I look back, but at the time, I just retired then and then. As soon as Paul said, come along, I just retired. I just phoned up Southend and said, I've retired. I'm going to go and go back. I've got a great opportunity to be the assistant manager at a club I'm very fond of and very close to, and I think I can help them in a very difficult period. And Ron Martin at the time said, well, Dad, you've got 2 years left of your contract, we're playing this Saturday. And I just pretty much said to him, look, if you keep me, I just won't be able to play. So, and I'm still good friends with Ron Martin because he done the honourable thing. He just literally tore up my contract and let me come along and jump into the deep end, really, because it was the deep end for 6 months, 3 or 4 months, sorry, trying to keep the club on and off the field in a very stable way.
Actually, you mentioned your coaching drills. I spoke to Darren Ambrose recently, and he credits that really with his goal against Sheffield Wednesday at Hillsborough. He said that your finishing drills, which was even doing drills where you're finishing from 3 yards out, just so that you get used to hearing the ripple of the net and scoring goals over and over again. Is that something that you did as a player first and took into coaching?
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, I'll just give you a little hint there, because I was coached by Don Howe. You know, Don Howe and Dave Sexton were at QPR with Mike Kelly. These three guys were Bobby Robson's right-hand men in the 1990 World Cup. So when they were coaching me, when I actually think back, we had to do a sports BTEC when I was 16, and I was writing the drills down. So I was writing drills down, not for thinking I'm going to go into coaching, for actually my BTEC in sport. So I was writing Don Howe and Dave Sexton's drills, and they just, you know, they were just there. My whole kind of life, they were just there, and they were in a draw, and I would always add to them. You know, then I started adding, taking a bit more serious, you know, the drills I got over the years. And the best feeling in football, I believe, is when you make contact with the ball and you know it's going to hit the back of the net, but the 30,000 people don't yet, because it's still got 12, 4 yards, 5 yards to go, but you know you've connected well, you've got right in this the line of the ball, you know what's happening. It's the best feeling. And I often used to, Don Howe, I always used to put that in my drills, making sure the outcome was a positive outcome. So it was only from 3 or 4 yards, and I think, if I can remember right, Dan, I would go back to sort of 7 or 8 yards, you know, to make sure they hit the back of the net. That was the whole outcome of it. And then if it was anything outside the box, then I would just simply say to people like Dan, like, just hit the goalkeeper. You know, it used to drive me mad. People hit over the bar. I'd say, outside the box, hit the goalkeeper. And fingers crossed, inside the box, then your technical ability, you know, needs to be shown, whether it be a strike low and hard, or you curl the ball, or, you know, whatever your technical ability is at the time. So I did, I do recall them, but, you know, over the years, it's not just with Darren. Over the years, you know, I've worked with some good players and been lucky enough to pass some information on to them, which hopefully has helped them.
It's funny you mentioned that moment after you strike the ball and you know it's going in, because that does remind me, because I used to sit behind the goal in the Holmesdale End when I was a kid. I'm pretty sure that reminds me of a goal you scored. It must have been the playoff semi-final in 97 against Wolves. I'm sure there's one of those where it's going up and everyone knows it's going in. I'm sure we celebrated before it had even gone in the net.
Chris, I think, again, if you want a quick story, mate, you've got me in a good mood today. I think that week was a very interesting week in my life, because if I can recall right, I played against Port Vale in the second last of the last game of the season. Now, we're in the playoffs. It's done. They've got nothing to play for. And I foolishly enough lashed out at a centre-back and I got sent off, which means at the time I couldn't play in the final if we got there. So I remember walking through the bar after the game and taking a little bit of abuse from the fans. You know, why'd you do that? And, you know, you're going to miss the final. And I was real low. You know, I was very, very low. And I was only young. I couldn't really take on what had happened. It's real, real low. Saturday afternoon, you know, you got to get in the picture of me. Very nice day. Get sent off, driving home. If we get to the final at Wembley, I'll be devastated. Fast forward a week later, Chris, I was on the bench and I come on and scored a couple of goals against Wolves. You're right, that's right. And I walked through the exact same bar as a hero. And it taught me in life a little bit that there is ups and downs in football, and that one week can be so low and so high, and not to take things so serious, because you always have a second opportunity. But that goal I scored against Wolves was straight from the training ground. You know, I'd done that through my youth career, and done that, I think, that season, scoring goals. And another funny one, six months later, I actually went to Wolves. I went to Wolves 6 months later, and in training, I'd done the exact same and scored a goal where I lobbed the goalkeeper, who was Mike Civil. And I told him, I was a little bit cheeky at that time, I told him that I've warned you once, you come off your line and I'll do this to you again. And let's see, chase me, Chris, the left foot down the training ground. And he caught me, and it wasn't pleasant. So it was a very good memory of that.
And the good memory for loads of Palace fans is the Sheffield Wednesday game at Hillsborough. So going into it, the team knows they only need a draw from the game to survive. So it's you going into a game again. But this is even more serious than the Stockport one, because with the club in administration, that really is like the whole future of the club is in the balance, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. You know, there was, we're in administration, you know, and there was, it was difficult. I'll try and take you through that kind of couple of days before and a couple of days after, Chris, because it was a whole series of things. And of course, we talk about the win and the great Alan Lee, I think it was, and Dan Ambrose. Am I right? Yes, it was. Mm. So leading up to that game, there was a lot of pressure. There was, because if we got into the League One, then you don't know if the 2010, you know, consortium are going to buy the club. You don't know what's going to happen. They're in the stadium. It's very difficult. We got the train up on the Friday, as we always did. It was a strike that Friday, getting up to Sheffield. The players travelled 3 hours standing up the whole way. We got to the other end at Sheffield, and because we'd missed our slot to train, we had to train at Barnsley. It was just, the commotion was just bubbling up, really was. We got back to the hotel. You know, Paul Hart was calm-ish, but he really tried to take the importance, you know, on himself, take the pressure himself, which I could see was, you know, straining on him. And I've often felt as an assistant, you got to really try and talk to the players, not like a manager. You know, you got to try and, you know, make sure they're okay and make sure they've remembered certain things. And I looked around, Chris, that Friday, and I pulled a few of the lads. You know, there were strong guys in there. It'd be fit any one he'd assembled. And I remember just saying things to them, look, you know, you've got to stay together no matter what happens. You know, I'd experienced this at Stockport. You know, you've got to go to the last minute. You've got to expect these certain things are going to come out of this game. You know, you can't lie down and wait for Sheffield Wednesday's training to come in. You've got to make sure you're on that track and you're pushing forward. And then we played the game, and when you play the game as a coach, it's kind of, you're done. There's not a lot to do. You know, I see these managers bawling shout at the side. That's perception. The perception they want to be seen doing something. I think a real manager's job's done at half-time and maybe the last 10 minutes of a game, 20 minutes of a game. So there's not a lot to be done during the game. Full credit's got to go to the players. You know, they stood up, they performed. Ambrose, yeah, we did that, you're right. And it's the same as a Man United goal, which I know you want to talk about. There were certain movement patterns that we'd done to put Darren into positions. And Darren was one that I felt that, I'm sure it was Sean Scano that cut the ball back. But these were drills straight off the training ground, Chris. Straight off Dan Howe's training ground, right? 20 years later into Dan Ambrose's training ground, that he cut the ball back. Keep the head still. Keep the shoulders pointing towards the goal. Don't lift the head when you strike the ball. Don't celebrate until 2 or 3 seconds after the ball hits the back of the net. These little things you've already put in place, and the outcome was wonderful. You know, really, really wonderful. It was a great achievement for the club, for the players. It put us in a position where the guys, you know, the consortium come in and bought the club, and it was really a real good feel factor. But there was still 3 or 4 weeks to go, Chris, when we finished that game. You know, there was still time that was difficult. But that particular win put us in a very good position for someone. And lucky enough, you know, Steve Parris and the consortium picked us up. But it was a difficult time because everyone was laid off. And there was myself, Christine, the groundsman, Phil. I tell you what, I'm on the phone to Dan Ambrose because Neil Warnock had won a QPR. And Neil Warnock had wanted to take Dan Ambrose, and he had a bid for him, £500,000-£600,000. And I was on the phone to Dan Ambrose. Paul Hart had left. I'd said, Dan, look, you guys are going to come in. We're going to build a team around you. You know, you're a fantastic fella, good lad. You enjoy it here. Stay, you know, make sure we build the team. I'm going to stay as well. You know, I've been promising the new guys that there's a part to play. And then my office phone started ringing, Chris. And I said, Dan, hold the line. I picked it up. It was a groundsman. And he asked me, could they get £40 to get some grass seeds? Because there was no money in the club or in the administration. So I had the phone in my ear with Phil screaming that he needs grass seeds and Dan Ambrose and one other. And that just showed you the difference in the club at that particular time. You know, it was really back to the wall. But thankfully, I gave Phil's £40 to buy some grass seeds and he was happy. And I gave Dan the speech to stay and he was happy. So the outcome again once again was good.
So Darren stays, George Burley comes in, along with probably quite a few players, I guess, because so many of the core players left that summer. So was it very much when you took over as manager, still part of the very start of a real rebuilding job?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt George at the time was the right manager. It was probably the wrong time for George. You know, I felt it was right for Crystal Palace to acquire a man with good experience and been there and done it. But I'm thinking George's life, he'd just come out of the Scotland job and it was difficult, and I don't think he had the energy to rebuild. And it was a difficult period for the 3 or 4 months, and obviously Steve Parish, the guys were new to it, and I'm trying to comfort a lot of people. That was my real job at that particular time, you know, comfort the guys and say, we'll be okay, we've got some good players, and obviously trying to help George, which I probably didn't do a good enough job at trying to help him get the team in the shape it needed to be. But when George left, it was a strange couple of weeks, because I'd felt that my time had come to the end. I'd felt that, you know what, I probably need to have spend some time with a family. It's been 20-odd years, and it sort of slowed down a little bit. And then Steve Parish was fantastic. You know, he gave me a couple of games. He'd take a few games, see how it goes. I'm going to be looking for a manager. If the manager wants you to stay, I'm brilliant. If he doesn't, you know, that's the way it goes. But I was very comfortable with that. You know, I was in a good place at the time. And then he talked to me about a few managers that he spoke to me quite likes, and I was a bit unsure about certain types of managers he was bringing in, because I knew it was a real strong dressing room. You know, Claude Davis, Paddy McCarthy, it was still an unforgiving dressing room who weren't doing very well. And the couple of weeks I got involved in it, I started feeling quite, you know, confident that I could do this job. And then I don't even know if the results went for me, Chris. I remember just having a good relationship with Steve, and I remember just saying to him one day, look, Steve, I think I could keep us up. I think I'm confident enough to say that to you. And then when I say that to him, I think he was a little bit, you know, why didn't you say that before me? Because he'd spent 2 or 3 weeks trying to find a manager. And pretty much the next day, he came into the office. We didn't do contracts. He said, yeah, I want you to have the job. We thought about it, and I want you to keep us up. We shook hands. No contract in exchange. In fact, that whole year, I actually just immersed myself in the job and started rebuilding. That's exactly what it was. I started rebuilding, having ideas about, you know, as I still have at the club, you know, I want to bring characters to the club, good personalities. I want to bring people that's motivated, people that have got the same agenda as the football club. And then I look at the athleticism, the technical ability of them. I need to bring that, and that's how it started. And we just rebuilt quite slowly. Now, I'd like it to be a lot quicker, but we didn't really have a lot of money at the time, so I had to make sure the pieces come in at the right time to move the club forward and keep us afloat as well.
And then you get to the League Cup quarter-final against Man United. Going into it, I mean, it was quite a brave move from you. You kept Lewis Price in goal because he'd played in the Cup. And then on the bench, it's a strong bench. You've got Spironi, Ramage, Parr, Ambrose, Jedinak, Everson and Murray. So what was your thinking going into that game of giving the youngsters a chance?
Yeah, I've always got a soft spot about that area, Chris. You know, I think, you know, one needs an opportunity to prove, you know, in life who they are. And I felt at the time that was a good occasion. I was swung because, you know, I need to give you a bit of a backstory. We, because of the TV, we had to play on a Wednesday night, but we'd already secured £170,000 to play Derby on the Friday night, which is actually 2 days later. So here's me taking a team up to Man United on the Wednesday and having to play on the Friday. And I recall we ain't doing too clever at the time, so I'm having to balance a very difficult situation where the club needs the money and, you know, the players would like to get a result. And maybe I'm doing a bit of injustice there, because I think at the time, Chris, I'd Sean Scarrow coming through, I'd Saha coming through, Joe O'Keefe coming through. You know, I believed in these players. Jimmy Neister needed a run out, Lewis Pratt. I actually believed in these players. And how I managed was pretty much, you know, there's 20 of them in the dressing room. And, you know, we're going to go to battle every Saturday and we need everybody. So it was very unfair of me just to sort of, when the big occasion come along, you know, chop one or two players that I actually believed in, Jonathan Parr. So, you know, I wasn't brave. I felt it was the right decision. And it was the right decision to, you know, take some energy into that game, making sure that we were on the front foot against them, and I felt we'd done that very well with the game plan. They had a good team, if I can remember. They had a good team out, so with a good game plan that, you know, we used the centre of the circle as our area that we would not let them have the ball in. You know, literally, we'd just pressure that area and not let them get started, because we felt if they get anywhere near our goal, they've got some lethal players. So we used that area to compress them. And then I think I can recall, you know, we're getting a lot of pressure put on us. There was an injury to someone. I can't remember. There was an injury to
Moxie.
Full sock. Who?
Dean Moxie. Just
Dean
before
Moxie,
half time.
There you go. Yeah, and I remember I had to, I can remember I had to sort of just change it. I needed to get a little bit more attacking on there with Darren. And I remember, I don't know if Darren came off of that. I made a couple of subs quite quickly, Chris, because I felt the game was there. And I felt the game needed some, you know, we needed to attack them a little bit more than we had done. And Darren come on. But with some, you know, Jonathan Parr, I remember Jonathan Parr making runs. He was making runs overlapping Darren, which was allowing Darren to come inside. And we spoke a lot about our two wingers driving inside. We spoke a lot of that the whole season. Because I felt that, I've often felt, if you put people like Dan Ambrose in the right position and you get the ball to him, then you're kind of Monday to Friday drills. You let him do what he's got to do. We all know what happened, but I think credit to his teammates because they knew the patterns of play we drummed up. And an overlapping Jonathan Parr allowed Dan Ambrose to come inside. A Wilfred Saha, you know, driving the ball into Darren behind the strikers. The centre forward, I'm imagining right now, I'm trying to picture the scene. I'm trying to imagine the centre forward would be spinning away to take the two centre backs away, leaving Dan Ambrose with 6 or 7 yards of space to, you know, produce probably one of the best goals that Old Trafford's ever seen.
Yeah, and that's what everyone talks about, Darren Ambrose. But that night really was, it was the night when Wilfred Zaha burst onto the scene for the rest of the world to see him. Did Sir Alex let you know that he was impressed by him that night?
Well, because I don't drink hot drinks, cups of tea and cups of coffee. It's just not my style. And it was the only time I've ever drunk a cup of tea. Because Sir Alex called me in the dressing room before the game and he said, "Sit down, son." And he poured me a cup of tea. And he said, "One or two sugars." I don't drink tea. And I said, "No, one sugar will be fine." And here's me drinking a cup of tea. I'm drinking a cup of tea. I don't like a cup of tea. And he's telling me about my team. So the man was unbelievable. He's telling me, you know, you're going to play Saha, and he's smiling. What about Scano? And this is before the game when the teams have not even been produced yet. So he knew us. He knew Saha. He knew Scano. He knew certain players that we had. You know, he's done his homework. And I'm trying to really, I'm very inexperienced, and I'm trying to say nothing, you know, and smile away and pretend I'm enjoying his cup of tea. But certainly after the game, you know, it was wonderful after the game, you know, and just praising our players' energy, attitude to keep on going. We had to hang in at times, you know, it wasn't just a Dan Ambrose goal, you know, they pegged us back to one each. It's very, very difficult. So we showed some mental strength, but certainly Wilfred Saha, you know, produced a performance everyone knew he was capable of, but now in the big scene, in the scene that's sort of one of the biggest in the world. And that was a time, about that time, I had to sort of really manage Wilfred's, you know, he's a great fellow, Wilfred. He's a really great guy, heart of gold. But of course, the circle around him at the time, the circle, you know, the media frenzy around him was really, the attention was on him. And I don't mind saying, I think I was maybe harder than I should have been on Wilfred, but it was for his own good at the time, because it was difficult for the young man, you know, the exposure he got from that game.
Now, Sir Alex, he's well known amongst other managers that he'd quite happily be someone you can call up for advice. Is he someone that you've spoken to over the years?
Yeah, you know, we've got that. You know, we've got one thing in common that not a lot of people understand, is, as you've highlighted in this video, Chris, you know. It's someone that does understand you. But, you know, I've got good relationships with a lot of managers, you know, and I think that's, you know, deep down, we are very competitive, but also I think that, you know, there's a mutual respect. And obviously coming from a, you know, similar background to myself, you know, there was that sort of connection, for want of a better word, that, you know, that was struck up. And, yeah, we do touch base from now and again.
So, moving on after that, we're going to leave 12-13 season, because we're editing a separate documentary about that, which we'll film something in the future. So just present day, just to finish off, how exciting is it at the moment for you in your role with the academy plans and the work that's already underway?
Yeah, well, really exciting. I think, you know, when I come back to the club 3 years ago, I've got many, many different roles in the football club, you know, but one of them was, and it's really, really strong from Steve Parish, you know, the academy's been neglected since we were in the Premiership. We've had to push all the money into the team to survive, which I think was the right decision. But he really tasked me and said, look, I really want you to put a lot of energy into this, the academy, and we've got to get into Cat 1 and we've got to build a new infrastructure. And so, you know, for the last couple of years, I've been working very closely with Steve and Gary and, you know, a few of the guys down there to put in place what I think is going to be a wonderful academy, and hopefully for many, many years to come, we'll service the first team. You know, we're in a great area, so we're going to spend a lot of money on a nice... the building's already there, but a real good refurb. Hopefully push on to Cat 1. Keep players, Chris, you know, keep players. Don't let them go to the Chelsea's and the Arsenal's. We see these Loftus Cheeks and people like that are from our area. So keep them in our area. You know, I don't want a flashy academy. I want an urban future. I want a place that represents our club and our area. I want to stay within the community. And another job of mine is to have pathways from the academy right to the first team. So, for instance, you know, one of the areas that the manager's highlighted, that we've got Patrick playing left back, but we haven't got much of a cover there. And, you know, and I'm looking at it and thinking, shall we go out there and buy a left back? You know, I've got my recruitment team that's, you know, we recruit all around the world, Chris, you know, and very proud of that. We've got a team that's at the top of press of a button. We know every left back in the world. But then I look at young Tarek Mitchell, who's coming from the academy, and, you know, so it's to make, not only put the infrastructure in place, to actually create pathways that allows these young gentlemen to have opportunities in life. So it's something that we are all very proud of. It's a huge effort. You know, we're working towards, still working towards it, but I think over the next year or so, you know, it's something we're all going to be very proud of.
Perfect. I think we'll leave things there. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day of Zoom meetings.
Yeah, there you go. I'm running late, about 11 o'clock Zoom, so I got to really cut you, Chris, and
catch
you soon, mate.
Yeah, get rid of me. Cheers, Dougie. That was brilliant.